She inspires, educates, and informs. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everyone. This is Gina Murphy Darling, and you are listening to Mrs. Green's World, a fun and informative place where we don't tell you what to think, but we sure do want you to. And Happy New Year, everyone. I cannot believe this is the first show of 2017, and I honestly can't believe that 2017 is here already, and before you know it, I will be wishing all of you a safe and happy 4th of July. So make every day and every minute count. It's going to be a big year on many fronts, and your being a part of this means the world to me and to our team. And so our sincere thanks for being a part of the ever-growing, ever-expanding Mrs. Green's World tribe and community. A big shout-out and thanks always to our sponsors, in particular for this show, Habitat for Humanity. They are the sponsor for the first show of the new year. And remember that they build homes, community, and hope. It's not just about building homes. They rely on donations of money, land, material, and time to construct every home they build, so there are many ways in which you can support them. If you are a Tucson listener, you can find more about them at habitattucson.org. If you are listening from anywhere around the country, just go to their national website. It's habitat.org, and you can literally put in your zip code and find out a way to get involved. And it's not just about money. They need volunteers. They need donations for their restores and habistores, so get ready to step up this year and support some of these wonderful causes that make a difference for our planet. Okay, and everybody get ready for a great show, our inaugural show for 2017. It's about community rights and rights of nature, a new paradigm. What could be better to start the new year than talking about a new paradigm? Joining us for this next hour is Kai Hushka. And Kai, I hope I said that correctly. Feel free to correct me if I did not. Yes, I want to always respect our guests with the proper pronunciation of their name. He is a community organizer in the Pacific Northwest for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And I think I'm going to call it the CELDF, because if not, it'll take up half the show to pronounce what the organization is. But as an organizer, Kai assists communities in Northwest and Hawaii with grassroots organizing with the support focused on elevating community rights and well-being over that of corporate exploitation. And I spent some time talking with him off air before the broadcast, and I hope we really can get deeply into just what this organization is about, and it will change maybe or shift for you your perception about how we are governed, how we are structured, and what the government does in terms of corporate partnerships. Kai is also a lecturer for CELDF's National Democracy School. We're going to find out about that. And an advisor to the Oregon Community Rights Networks. He lives with his wife and two young boys in Spokane, Washington. And Kai, we're really thrilled to have you. It couldn't be more timely. I'm thrilled that I learned about this organization at Bioneers this past October and was really inspired by the presentations made by Thomas Lindsay and Mari Margill, I believe, and the whole Occupy the Law concept. So I'm happy to have you, and I'm glad you said yes, and let's get started.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks for putting me at the front end of the year. So
I know, what a way to start the year. I mean, isn't it serendipitous? It is about a new paradigm, and it is a new year, and I think that, you know, quite honestly, I'm standing in my truth. Many of us are concerned about lots of people's rights in the weeks and months to come, and about finding our voices and why this can be just such a good thing on many fronts. So why don't we start with you giving us an overview of just what the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund is and how and why it got started in the first place.
Yeah, we've been around since 1995, so, you know, 20 odd some years. Originally started as a means for communities to have access to legal representation. As most people probably have become familiar with, lawyers are not cheap.
Right.
And especially when it comes to
especially when
larger,
you need one.
Yeah, especially when you right when you need one. Exactly. And especially also when it comes to, you know, larger community issues. Initially the work was really around more, I guess you could say, environmental based situations. And so the organization started to say, hey, we want to make ourselves available, and the idea was to be free, so that communities didn't have to carry the burden of cost of paying for attorneys. And so that was a big sort of pillar of how we instituted ourselves, and it's pretty much how we operate today, you know, to make ourselves accessible. And the other big, you know, foundational reason for creating this new organization was to uphold what our belief was at that time, that the best environmental laws on the planet were here in the United States, and there just weren't enough attorneys out there for communities to have access to enforce those laws. And that was our premise for beginning. We have gone in a very, very different direction since then, in large part because the understanding came to be is that these environmental laws were really less about protecting communities and an environment, more about allowing corporate exploitation to be basically run through the system as easily as possible. And in fact, the better that we did our job of, for instance, polling or pointing out deficiencies in permits, the better that the corporations got at submitting better permits. Because, you know, the system in large degree is set up to be predetermined that something is going to happen, a particular project, that it's already been decided by a higher level, the regulations have been written, the laws have been written, and in large part our participation as community members is really at best ceremonial, that we sort of get a chance to show up, give our peace of mind on something, and often communities are looking at a much fuller picture than the law looks at in regards to fracking or, you know, GMOs or pesticides or whatever it may be, corporate development, so that when we come up to the microphone to speak, we actually are speaking the greater truth and the fuller picture of what those particular projects would mean for a community. Yet the law really looks at it very narrowly and is also predisposed to allow that project to go forward regardless of our testimony. And so we were done as an organization basically participating in a corporate-written game, and it was the communities themselves that started moving us in a very different direction. So our work today in large part falls out into that grassroots organizing that you mentioned, the educational piece about getting people to more fully understand how our system of governance is set up, why it's set up to favor the greatest economic interests, why it is so difficult to do environmental protections, because we have to realize, you know, all the data has pointed to the fact that we are worse off than we were when those environmental laws of the federal level were put in place 40-some years ago. So some people should be scratching their heads saying, well, what's not working? And so the education stuff is big. The action part is bigger, which means we have to sort of be the ones to make the change happen. And then the legal stuff comes in around helping communities basically draft new laws, new rights-based laws to defend themselves, defend the environment, defend the civil rights, political rights, economic rights of the people in the community, and then, of course, to defend those laws as they get adopted. And so our work comes in as a support mechanism to what's happening on the ground in a lot of places right now, as well as beginning to elevate itself to the state level and also beginning to kind of consider what a federal-level change looks like. Because as we may get into later, what we're dealing with here is a foundational problem. And when I say foundational, it goes all the way into the U.S. Constitution itself as the main driving governance document that we operate from. It has basically predetermined flaws in it. And so when we try to live more sustainably and confront certain civil rights even and other types of rights protections, we keep running into barriers, and what we have to realize is the system isn't broken. The system actually operates perfectly fine because it operates on a very different platform than I think what we've been spoon-fed around what democracy and liberty and freedom and rights is all about, because it's only when we come into really direct contact with it do we really get a chance to really see how that machine operates. And I think this work is really about understanding that, dismantling that system, and really putting something new in its place. So I think it's appropriate perhaps that the first discussion of the year really is sort of a, what's the resolution for our community? Well, I think it's to ditch this idea that we have to reform the system, or the truth is we have to revolutionize the system, and it's going to be up to us to do that, and are we ready for that challenge?
What an impactful statement. I mean, truly, I'm sitting here getting, you know, waves of goosebumps because what you say rings so true. And one quick question and then a much bigger question, but I do understand that you provide pro bono and low-cost legal assistance, which is so needed to grassroots groups, of which I am part of some of them, and it's very overwhelming. How do you support yourselves? I mean, it's, everybody doesn't work for free, I would assume.
Sure. So we that puts the burden on us to fundraise in other arenas. And so whether it's individual members who donate to CELDEF, whether it's us putting in for grant applications, whether it's about trying to find some major donors, that's the arena we work in to help then make it more accessible for the communities who are, you know, basically that first line of resistance, as well as really where the nexus of the paradigm change has to come from. It has to come from the places where we live. And so it's about empowering communities, empowering people. And so we continue to be able to exist through other means of fundraising, though the truth is even the fundraising apparatus is really part of that corporate system. It keeps feeding money towards certain activism and certain organizing that really is about reinforcing the system, not actually dismantling the system. So it goes that deep as well around how money flows. And if, you know, the truth is if we could even divert a portion of that money towards really, again, revolutionizing the system instead of basically, in our view, throwing it down the drain to try to reform it, we could actually be further along. So even the money funding system needs to change, because there's plenty of money out there that unfortunately keeps being driven into organizing that really is expecting different results through a set of rules that, of course, are not about acknowledging, you know, people, the environment as it needs to be, but still about this corporate exploitation, this corporate plundering, really, that in large degree was the foundation of the U.S. Constitution, which was about how do you extract resources as fast as possible, because that's how you built the great nation. That was the view of the time of those who were in charge. And that's still the document we have today. So when we really look at how the Monsantos of the world work, or Waste Management Corporation, or, you know, the large timber companies or the oil and gas organizations, well, they're operating under that same set of blueprints. And so it's no wonder why they do what they do in the manner that they do it, because that's what the governmental documents basically subscribe to, and then all the reinforcing laws protect, so that when we want to do the good stuff, the sustainability stuff, you know, the protection of really basic human rights even, it is so very, very difficult to do, because it's something that the foundational sort of DNA of the system wants to reject, because it's not natural for it to want to do that. So that's a large degree of this work, is to point that out and to say, well, we have an opportunity here to really build a different form of governance. And that also means confronting the current system as it is, exposing it for what it is, and then moving ourselves forward in mass to change things, because otherwise, you know, we're just speeding off the cliff.
And, you know, we spoke a little bit off air about the issue we have here in Pima County with Monsanto coming to our community, which I, of course, think is doubly insulting because it's the national headquarters for Mrs. Green's world. And I'm like, what? But it's the quintessence of everything that you just said, where we found out about a deal that was signed, sealed, and delivered. Monsanto has the property purchased. They're starting construction. It's near a high school, which makes it extremely sad for me. And they gave a huge $500,000 to the high school, which is in an impoverished area. So I understand that. I'm not so narrow-minded that I don't understand the superintendent of that school needs money. So they have $500,000 to help with their school. But what you said about the general public, I mean, I think I'm smart, and I think I'm up on these kind of issues. And I sat in a meeting for 4 hours, and at the conclusion, you know, some of us, the debriefers, sat around, and it's done. All of the 4 hours that stormed the Board of Supervisors area were just feel-good moments for us. We thought we were really doing something, and we did. But in my opinion, it's done. They're coming. The laws are in place to support their being here. They're getting a tax break, which I found extremely upsetting, since their last quarter was a $4.2 billion profit. But it is just what you said. And I realize that I'm on kind of a rant, but it didn't come home to me to the depth that you just described until I sat there and I thought, it's done. It's already done. The laws are in place. We, the people, are going to rally. There's going to be public hearings. And at the end of the day, Monsanto's coming to Marana.
Yeah, and that's your story there, unfortunately, is a story that probably operates on a daily,
yes,
daily level all across the country. And whether it's Monsanto, whether it's about corporate development, you know, whether it's even about educational systems,
right.
There's big pushes now to even more centralize education, and I think that's also another thing we have to kind of run into, and maybe our own minds. I mean, the truth is this work of community rights and rights of nature that's happening nationally and internationally is in some ways less about how the system works, because eventually you can figure out the system. It's not rocket science. Even though it's well camouflaged, it can be deciphered, and you can figure out the origins of these things and how they work. I think the biggest issue is our own self-doubt, because I think we have been spoon-fed this sort of myth of American democracy, for one. And this idea of we the people, meaning that, you know, all government is supposed to be founded on the people's will, really about the protection of rights.
Of the people, by the people, for the people, right? Yes.
So we run into that. And like you just pointed out in your story there locally, when we see it in operation, it's the complete antithesis. And so there is that shock value that almost paralyzes us. The question is, once that paralysis, let's say, wears off, well, what do we do about it? And I think in large degree, the conclusion needs to be, well, we got to change it. And I think the only way that we change that kind of a system, just like other people have had to change unjust systems in the past, is you have to embrace your inner disobedience, because the system doesn't want to recognize you in the way that it needs to. And it's just legalizing unjust, immoral, unethical behavior. So why do we keep following that set of law if that's what it's going to do? Just like the abolitionists or the revolutionaries or the suffragists or the civil rights movements of the 50s and 60s, those folks understood that we can't subscribe to that anymore, because it doesn't even recognize us really as part of the system. It sees us as property in large degree. And so how do we come to grips with that? Well, we have to reject that, we have to challenge it, and then we also have to lay out the reality of what it is that we want. And that's in large degree, again, what the community rights, beginning of what could be a movement is about, which is, challenging the dominant system, rejecting the elements that are really unjust and immoral and unethical, and then laying out its future in a manner that is really about true sustainability and about founding governments on the basis of rights and making sure that people in the communities where they live have the greatest power to govern when it comes to protecting health, safety, and welfare. And that's not what we have today. And until we understand that, come to grips with it, and are willing to mobilize on changing that, the system will keep doing what it's doing, which is basically steamrolling the planet.
Stomping
and burning,
on
and
our
burning
rights.
It up.
Yes, burning it up. And we all are going to pay if we don't wake up and really find our voices. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, there's two things I'd like to start off with. One is kind of trends that I've noticed in the past year or so where states are stomping on local municipality rights, and I can give you an example in Arizona. And then where do you think it's going in terms of student organizations and some of these movements actually suing the government for the violation of their rights? And is that what it's going to take? Everybody, please stay here with us. What an amazing conversation we're having. More from Kai Hushka. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new on-demand podcast every week at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio or SoundCloud mobile apps. We are a proud member of the iHeartRadio, Glimmerglass, and Speak Up networks. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Stay in touch with information about healthy living, sustainability, contests, and events by signing up for our e-newsletter on our website. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. But right now, back to Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. Thanks so much for being with us. Joining us for this hour is Kai Hushka, a community organizer in the Pacific Northwest for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. As an organizer for CLDF, Kai assists communities in the Northwest and Hawaii with grassroots organizing support focused on elevating community rights, which, if you're listening the first hour, have been stomped, trumped on. Just, we don't even have them, so what are we kidding ourselves? And well-being over that of corporate exploitation. Kai is also a lecturer for CLDF's National Democracy School and advisor to the Community Rights Network. And this fund has become the principal advisor to activists, community groups, and municipal governments struggling to transition from merely regulating corporate harms to stopping those harms by asserting local, democratic, let's focus on that word, control directly over corporations. And I do want to comment on our wonderful voice in the break. When we put up a show, it's on our website, and we would love for more listeners to comment. There are lots of you that have thoughts about these issues. We get emails, but we'd love to engage more of a public conversation so that other people can see your comments. We approve them very quickly, and I'm sure there are lots of people listening to this show that hopefully will be inspired to act. So, Kai, thank you so much, not just for being with us, but for representing an organization that we should all be paying attention to and figuring out how to help support.
Yeah, no, thanks for the space. I mean, you know, it's really about people in communities in different parts of the country that give us we don't exist without them, let's put it that way.
Right,
so
right.
It really is about everyday people, in large cases, people who've really never been, you know, activists, you know, stepping forward saying, enough's enough. And I think that's, in some ways, that's the simple recipe, you know, enough's enough, and, you know, we're going to stand our ground, and we're going to advance really a more sane, sustainable, just system of governance, because what we have today is very much out of control.
And after listening to you for the first segment, it almost isn't an erosion of our rights. It goes so much deeper than that. It's rights that we thought we had that we didn't, if I interpret what you said correctly. And in my opinion, we better be paying attention in the weeks and months to come, heighten our awareness and, you know, amp up our listening level. Because I wonder, is there a danger of more of our rights being eroded? In general, what your sense is of that and the sense of the, you know, your colleagues? And is there a way that you can, you know, I talked about our rights being stomped, and the specific question I had in Arizona, for example, I've never seen where the state government banned municipalities from their own, you know, it was plastic bags. And our state legislature, in its infinite wisdom, said, we're banning the ban of plastic bags. So some of our municipalities and communities had plastic bag bans in effect. and the state made it illegal to ban plastic bags. Talk about your rights being stomped on. So that's one example. And then the other one, which we can, is another conversation, but how I see student organizations, for example, suing the federal government. But in terms of the real deal of our rights, is there going to be a good part to this? That's a long question. I know, but it's a very important one for those of us that want to have hope and want a call to action.
Yep. Yeah, so we can take those three things in the way that you lay them
Thank
out.
You.
And I think, you know, it comes with sort of understanding what are you up against. You know, you mentioned about communities done being regulated and really asserting their power to prohibit things that they find to be destructive as well as to embrace the good stuff, you know, truly, you know, implementing sustainable food systems, for instance, against
right.
the industrial model of food production, if you can even call it food. And one of the things we need to, I think, understand, and we've tried to put it out in as simplest terms as we can, and the way that we try to get people to understand the world that they live in, whether they can see it or not, is that your community basically sits inside a box, and you are contained about what you can do inside that box. And the box is, in large cases, always ever shifting, meaning that it, in large, you know, often constricting. So as your example, you know, the use of preemption, that's basically one side of the box, because we have a system of governance where the federal basically trumps the state, and the state trumps the local. You know, there's some variation there, but the basic model is we have a very centralized preemptive form of governmental, the structure of it. And the practice of preemption, which is a very common practice, so you pointed out how it seemed crazy that they were going to ban communities from trying to ban plastic bags.
It's well, like what?
Yeah.
Like what?
I mean, think about it. We're just talking plastic bags here. We're not,
right.
you know, I mean, yes, it'd be, we should be getting rid of them because they're fossil fuel based and
but
all
the
reasons
scale,
why.
But on the big scale, it's not. It's
yeah,
not.
But
yeah.
the use of preemption is used all the time. So many states preempt, for instance, communities from trying to ban GMOs or from having anything really to do to define agriculture. State governments ban communities, for instance, wanting to pass higher minimum wage than what the state does. States ban communities from trying to ban fossil fuel projects. States ban communities from denying certain corporate development. So the use of preemption is a very, very common thing, and it's been used for quite some time. So the idea of preemption is what we would call one of the legal doctrines, sort of the corporate hammer that's used against communities. And so that's one thing we have to remember is we're going to run into that preemption sort of side of the box. The other sides of the box consist of things like, you know, corporate constitutional rights, which sort of get defined in two ways. So there's sort of the meat of the Constitution, which talks about commerce. So this idea of, you know, trade of goods and services, for instance. Well, a community can't ban, for instance, even plastic bags because, well, plastic bags happen to be a form of commerce, and you and your community really don't have the authority to interfere with commerce because that's a federal-level congressional power. So you run into things like the Commerce Clause or, you know, what's the more sexier thing for people to talk about is this idea of bills of rights protections for corporations. So corporations have used the judicial system to find themselves having the same rights protections as living, breathing human beings. So they have Fourth Amendment rights protections, Fifth Amendment rights protections, First Amendment rights protections, 14th Amendment rights protections, and they use these things to make sure that communities or even states can't interfere with their business, basically, because what they can claim is, if you're going to treat my business differently from some other kind of business, so for instance, if you want to embrace a local economy, which means you want to make sure that local businesses is better situated and well-funded and well-capitalized and all the things that we know make for a strong local economy, well, those big mega corporations can sue your community if you try to pass some law saying, well, we're going to give greater favoritism to the small business, for instance, on the grounds that you are violating the equal protection rights of that business under the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So it's another barrier. The sort of fourth side of the box, most states are considered to be Dillon's rule states. And Dillon was a gentleman that basically came up with this concept that municipalities are under the control of the state, and that whatever powers the municipality has to be given by the state. And powers that are given by the state can be taken away by the state if it so sees fit. So, for instance, in Ohio, there was a move to come in and basically put a state administrator to regulate how the educational system is going to work in the city of Youngstown. Or in Flint, Michigan, when they put in the emergency manager around the water issue, well, that person wiped out all of the local governmental systems in order to put a state-appointed person in a position to monitor the water of the community of Flint. And we know how well that went.
Really? So it was. How's that working for us? Great. Just great.
And that operates under one of these. Yeah, that operates under one of these legal doctrines. So when we say we have no decision-making power, that we really don't govern in our communities, that we are corporate property, we're not saying that just to be sensational. We say that because it's true. And so once you recognize that you are in a box, the question is, can you continue to live in the box, depending on what it is you're trying to address, or are you going to be about getting yourself out of that box and dismantling it so that you are, in essence, in a position of greater governmental power and governance power at the local level when, again, it comes to protecting rights and advancing rights, that we don't have that power today because of the way that the legal system is set up, the way that box is set up. We call it the box of allowable activism. You know, is that box adequate for addressing, you know, worker rights issues or other civil rights issues or environmental issues or whatever it is? And if the question is no, which in large degree is the case pretty much with whatever issue you are trying to address, well, then you have a choice. You can continue to try to live in that box and somehow live under the delusion that you're going to get the equity and the justice you deserve, or you have to get yourself out of that box and start charting a new course for yourself. And that's really what's happening in the community rights world and the rights of nature world in this country.
And it just makes me want to scream. And I have to tell you this, what flashed across my mind, the weirdest things flashed across my mind, is it's almost a Saturday Night Live skit. I'm not kidding. It's like, what? You thought you had rights? You got to be kidding me. And I can just see it going on and on. It's almost a parody. It's so overwhelmingly, on the one hand, depressing, but then to know better is to do better. And I and many of our listeners will understand that. And what you described to me off air and what you've just described is we are still, it's a colonization model where they're taking up, you know, they colonized the United States. There's that whole story. And we thought it was to get away from oppression. But there's a lot of the underpinning of this is we don't have the rights. And we didn't know the laws were written to protect the government's complicity with corporations. Is that an oversimplification or exaggeration?
No, I think that's pretty much a dead on bullseye statement, you know, because we took the English form of government wholesale, and then we built a governing document that basically was in large degree a mirrored reflection of the British colonial government of the 1700s. And it, you know, if you see it from that truth, it should become clear as to why it's been so difficult to basically live off of a rights-based governance model when we don't have that from the get-go. We've been sort of trying to gerrymander and jerry-rig the form of governance we have and the laws we have to do what we would like it to do and what justifiably it should do. And that's why I said, you know, why this idea of reform is a dead end, because the system's never been set up that way. I mean, think about the Bill of Rights, even from the U.S. Constitution. I mean, that wasn't an addendum, an add-on, in large degree to placate the political situation to get the main body, the Constitution, voted in. But we should also remember historically that Bill of Rights, it only applied to those who were seen as having rights at the time, which was basically the 1% of of their time of our country. So it's not as if it applied to women or Native Americans or African Americans or, you know, white men without property. The Bill of Rights was basically meaningless. And of course, we've evolved somewhat since then, but
somewhat.
We also see how difficult. I mean, think about the 14th Amendment. Well, that 14th Amendment came to protect corporations before it actually really applied to women, or in large degree even applied to African Americans, who it was intended to be about. So, I mean, that's how perverted and crazy, and as you said, sort of Saturday Night Live our system is. And so, you know, it's the awareness moment that we have to come to that then creates hopefully some potential for something new to emerge. And to your other question about, you know, the use of the legal system to recognize, you know, rights to climate, for instance, which I think is what your question was about, in the sense of kids stepping forward saying, hey, I have a right to a healthy climate. I've got a right to climate, because without that, there is no human race.
There's no life.
Yeah, I mean, those are the right kinds of questions. And, you know, the court up to this point has, to a degree, recognized that as a fundamental right. And there's a long way to go for that particular legal case. But I think, if anything, and what we've also understood, too, around the legal system is the legal system is an arena of which we can help build the movement. And what I mean by that is, we don't go into the illegal arena in some belief that somehow the legal system is going to slap itself in the head and says, oh, we got all these legal doctrines wrong, you're right, we should be protecting rights and not commerce and property and so on and so forth. However, you know, we can test the legal system in order to potentially get certain legal determinations that could be of help to us. But I think also just to show how perverted that system is. So when we walk into court with community bills of rights, for instance, you know, as we're doing right now in a town called Grant Township, Pennsylvania, who's fighting to keep frack wastewater out of their community, you know, the toxic byproduct of the fracking industry.
How dare they?
And when that community walks in saying, you know, our right to water and our right to govern to say that our water is more important than your toxic waste, to the company saying, no, our right to put in that toxic waste overrides your right to protect your water, that's a very different argument than walking into court under what we call the regulatory world to regulate how bad you're going to get poisoned or polluted, which is really your only potential option under that system, which is to say, well, we don't think we should get that amount of poison, we should get this amount of poison. And what our community is saying, we don't want any of that poison, and we have fundamental rights about why that's the case. And we're going to challenge this notion that the legal system should recognize that corporate right to pollute us versus our right to protect ourselves and our right to be self-governing people in our community to do so as being paramount to that of so-called corporate rights. And so it's a very different argument, both from a legal sense, but also conversationally and, you know, activation and organizing-wise out into the greater society, which is to say, why aren't we the governors, really, of our own community? If you know, we thought we had this, you know, we the people, you know, by the people, of the people scenario, then, well, it should be able to be exercised. And if it's not, well, that needs to change. And we have to build a movement, so we have to find arenas of which to build the movement from. And so the legal arena is one of these places of which that exposure can happen, of which the movement potentially can build. And it's also no different than other movements. You know, the suffragists, the Susan B. Anthony's who went and voted, well, they knew they were breaking the law. They didn't expect the law to somehow say, oh, we got it wrong, yes, you can vote. But they used it as an organizing tool. And I think that's really what these communities are saying. Well, one, it's our government, and we're going to act in that manner. And then two, we're going to force the courts to really, you know, have to address some very serious questions, and whatever the outcome, but it's to our advantage to start occupying all the different realms, whether it's our local government, whether it's the legal system, you know, it's our communities, it's our government, it's our system, and we have to start acting that way.
Right.
And let's not shy away from it, but let's embrace it. And really from a, you know, I guess a military sort of, or even a sports metaphor standpoint, you're better off being on the offense. And so much of our activism really has been on the defense. We've been on our heels. And like you pointed out earlier, you know, you show up to the hearing and it really just feels like you're, you know, you're talking to nobody. Well, that's in large degree because the system automatically puts us on our heels in the defensive. And we have to stop thinking that way and organizing that way. You have to organize very differently and be more on the offense and seize, really, or occupy our own governments, which is a strange notion, but that's also where we're at. Where
occupy
we have to,
the law, yes.
Yeah.
Everybody, we'll be right back. I'm hanging on to our guests' every word in such a meaningful conversation. Please stay here with us and hear more from Kai Hushka, from the community organizer, from the CELDF.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Mrs. Green's World. And we're talking about community rights and the rights of nature, and basically an entirely new paradigm, a shift in our mindset, and helping us to really ground into that, to go deeper into that, is Kai Hushka. He's a community organizer in the Pacific Northwest for the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. I'm sorry that was such a rough ending, but I'm so caught up in what you're saying. It's like, okay, we have to have another break. And let me just mention that the mission of CELDF is to build sustainable communities by really helping people to assert their rights to local government and the rights of nature. The CELDF is building a movement for community rights and the rights of nature to advance democratic, economic, social, and environmental rights, building upward from the grassroots level to the state, federal, and international level. And Kai, I have to ask you, it's more like a philosophical question. I think that since we were all raised to believe that we drank the Kool-Aid of we are a government of the people, for the people, and by the people, when people like me hear this conversation and get informed, that belief feels violated, and you do want to find your rights. You do want to fight for your rights. Does that make sense? So it's like it really wasn't that, but since that we believed it and now it's not, it makes you even more, you know, willing to become an activist. And I want my rights. I want the rights of my community to be protected, and I want a healthy environment. So does that question make sense? It inspires me.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you and I talked, you know, off air, you know, I mentioned that when people sort of come to that conclusion, you know, that myth bubble's been popped. For a lot of people, it does become liberating in the sense that saying, okay, well, then that means we have to fight for that. And so we are that generation now. So we thought we had it, but we really didn't. So we know we're supposed to have it. Well, I guess we have to sort of roll up our sleeves and fight for it. And that's really what's happening. So, I mean, just sort of statistically to give people a sense of what that means here, at least nationally, you know, there's 200 some communities that have passed these community rights laws, as we call them. Really, this idea of asserting self-governance, about denying harmful corporate projects on the basis of protecting of rights. Largely, most of the work has really been environmentally based, so protecting, you know, your water, your air, your soil, you know, what we probably consider to be some pretty simple building blocks of life. And, you know, tied to that, also there's 36 some communities that have really pushed a new paradigm around the protection of the environment of Mother Nature, and that is really about recognizing the rights of nature. In very short form, the way that the system works today, the legal system, is nature is property. It has no rights, and so we treat it like property. And that's why corporations can do what they do around, you know, extractive types of industries, or why, you know, CAFOs, you know, factory farms exist, really exclusive of the environmental impact that it has. Because, you know, we see nature and ecosystems as a thing. And so these communities have moved a new paradigm of law saying, well, no, nature has rights and it's really our duty to protect them as the human species, as part of those broader systems. And so, believe it or not, that work emerged out of rural Pennsylvania, conservative Pennsylvania, and eventually found its way into the country of Ecuador in 2008, who's now one of two places, really, nationally speaking, that recognizes nature's rights. So the work is emerging in all kinds of places now and in all kinds of ways, but it does come from exactly what you just described, which is saying, hey, we're being seen as property, just as like nature is, and we don't like that, and we're going to do something about it. And that's what sort of built things to where it is today, which is, you know, about 9, 10, 11 states that have passed these laws. You have states now that are also looking at state constitutional change, because, as I mentioned earlier, there's this relationship between the federal to state to local that in a large degree is upside down, where we put the federal at the top and the local at the bottom. It really needs to be the other way around, where the greatest power to protect and advance rights needs to be localized, and that the other levels of government need to recognize that and really basically bow down to that authority. How it works today is what you described also earlier, which is the ability of the state to squash local decision-making, whether it's about banning plastic bags, whether it's about protecting the, you know, the rights of the LGBT community, whether it's about advancing minimum wage, whether it's about making decisions about development. Again, like I said, almost on a daily basis, you see preemption being used, or, you know, there's places now that are, for instance, looking at trying to protect, you know, undocumented people in this country. And so they're sort of setting up what have been defined as these sanctuary cities. And you have states that are actually banning the ability of communities to become sanctuary cities. Well, they're using that notion that the state trumps the local. And no pun intended on the Trump there, but that is how our system functions. And it can function that way because it's been built that way and twisted that way, and it can operate that way because it's, again, sort of pre-written that it will do that. And so it's about pushing up against that, also looking to dismantle that, and really building a different form of governance for ourselves that really is built on rights, and let's say really built on true sustainability, because we can't get there on the model we have today. We have to build something new. I mean, Thomas Lindsay from CELDAP has said, well, we need a sustainability constitution. You know, we don't have that today. We've got a very old document that in a large degree, in a lot of different ways, doesn't function. And so there's got to be some thinking and movement building to figure out how to basically chuck that, rewrite something that's really about us and about the planet and about nature and about basic rights. Otherwise, we'll keep getting what we're getting, which is not looking all that great.
That's an understatement. What I want to ask you about in the time flying is it you cannot be everywhere. What I loved about the model, what I loved about the website, is that people can find ways to get involved. We can look at things that you've done. There's a way to organize in our community, and I've been making notes about community organizers, very, very active, robust, caring community here in the southwestern, you know, part of Arizona. We are not necessarily always in compliance with up the highway, but there's a lot of wonderful things going on here in terms of human rights and, you know, city of gastronomy and our food supply and food security. But how do you, your advice on the listeners that are here, everybody can't have you, because there's not enough of you to go around and not enough money. So what is the way, the most effective way in terms of a call to action for people to get involved to fight for their rights? Because they're coming up everywhere. It's coming up everywhere.
Yes, I think kind of two things, or maybe three things. But, you know, one is, you know, understanding the full picture, which is
right.
That's the starting point. Because if you don't understand the full frame, it's hard then to address the full reality of what we're up against.
And it can be a waste of time, literally.
Yeah, yeah, because it's very easy to get sucked down a certain path or, you know, down sort of a dead-end corridor, or to ignore the full scope of it and say, well, we're just going to concentrate on this. And unfortunately, knowing that our opportunity to really change things, it may be a very small window to do so, we should be fully prepared to change the whole thing. Because otherwise, what we've seen in the past is that opportunity, the door slams shut, and then that system finds a way to reaccumulate power into fewer and fewer hands. And then we're left with having to fight back against it at a later time. So
right.
I think we really need to be prepared to go the full distance. So that's sort of the first step, I think, is people becoming aware of that, whether it's, you know, going to democracy school, you know, digging into our website, doing their own research. You know, we've got a new film out called We the People 2.0 that
was
produced.
I was going to ask you about that, too.
Yeah.
Watch the film.
Yeah, the film, I think, you know, tells the personal stories of communities, but also helps to kind of lay out the, you know, that box of allowable activism and just really what we're up against. So whatever means that people can kind of understand that, you know, what we're up against and we have to do something very differently than we've been doing, you know, that's usually the kind of the first step. Then really it's about getting active, and that, I think it's about looking into one's community saying, well, what is it that we're facing? You know, is it around immigration? Is it around education? Is it around gentrification of neighborhoods? Is it an environmental issue? You know, what do we keep running into that's really keeping us from, again, what it is we want? We often say that so much of activism still today is what we can get, that question of what can we get. And sort of people look at the system or the political viability and say, well, we can get this. And so there's immediately starting from this place of compromise. And instead of asking yourselves, well, what is it that we want, which is a very different question.
Yes.
And building from that vantage point and understanding, yeah, it's a tougher road to hoe, but the reality is that what we can get stuff, we've been doing that for decades now. Or police accountability, for instance, police violence. You know, people have been playing the what we can get game in that arena as more and more people suffer from that use of the police state. And so the question I've put out there and others have put out there, you know, is stop asking that question. You should be asking it, what do you want? And if you start asking that question about what you want, you have the potential then to build a very different kind of organizing. And most likely than not, that organizing is going to have an edge of disobedience, because it has to, because the system does not want to recognize the things that we want to have it to recognize. And that means we have to basically paint it as the illegitimate system, and not in a manner that just says you're the illegitimate system, but in a manner that says, well, here's what the legitimate system needs to look like. And that's where the local lawmaking comes into play. This is why these communities have moved community bills of rights around fracking or factory farms or worker rights or protections of religious beliefs or whatever it is, to say, well, this is really what it should look like. This is what governance should look like, and we need the greatest power to define the future of our community, and we're going to do so through formulating our government in a manner that recognizes that, even if it means challenging the legal doctrines out there, and in some ways breaking the law to change the law. Well, that's what we're left with. So I think that's another thing for people to come to grips with, is we have very little to work with. And we have to recognize that and say, okay, well, here's what we have to work with. Let's embrace that, and let's start to get busy here, because there isn't that silver bullet out there that somehow we can latch onto or that we haven't found out about. We really have to see that it's that lopsided at the moment. But again, just like other people's movements in the past, whether it's been here in the United States or other places, it's always been lopsided and hugely lopsided, but people have found a way to come together to make that difference. And whether they, you know, whether people get connected to our organization or not, they can do this. In fact, part of building these state community rights networks is about making sure that the communities can do the work themselves, the people in the communities. And so it's less so about any organization and more so about people. You know, once they get to some basic understanding, once they get some level of sort of how to activate, it is about people being empowered to really be, you know, the governing body of their community, because we've let someone else basically, you know, watch over us, and we've seen what that has resulted in, and it's time we seize that power back, even if it means upending the system to do so. Well, that's most likely what it's going to take, and we need to embrace that and be ready for it. And you and I also talked about, you know, the good things coming out of the issue or the situation there in Standing Rock. You know, those are the things I look at as the, you know, people's willingness to again be disobedient on justifiable grounds and not back down. And I think that's the mentality that needs to permeate everywhere, because it can't just be in one place in the northern part of the country, because guess what? In the issue of pipelines, there's all kinds of pipelines being built everywhere right now. And, you know, it's the system that keeps legalizing and authorizing those pipelines, just like it will do at Standing Rock. I mean, that's the other sad reality, is that pipeline will get built, no
yes.
doubt about it.
Yes, and it'll hurt some other environmental yeah. area in which it is laid.
Yeah.
Come on,
so that's,
people.
That's the sad reality.
Yes.
They may have nudged it away from one particular place, you know, good for them, but... You know, a lot of people say, well, not in my backyard. Well, our reaction is, well, not in anybody's backyard is the mentality we have to take, because, you know, burning of fossil fuels is killing us, literally. And so, yeah, the pipeline not going where it was going to go through potentially for the sake of the water, that's fantastic, but that pipeline's still getting built, destruction is still being caused, and guess what? The folks in the Standing Rock area are not immune to that. So we have to shift our mentality to, again, to a whole other level. I mean, we take the energy that represented, but it has to go to a very different place. And I think that's what the community rights folks are trying to show others, because the recipe that they've been working off is also very simplistic, because once they understand sort of that the agencies and the government and the corporations are definitely not about the health and welfare and the future of their communities, when they do step forward to assert that self-governing rights and assert the rights to protect their water and air and soil, for instance, well, their understanding or their hope is, I suppose, is that other communities will do the same thing. And then if some other community does it, then maybe another community will do it and another community will do it. And really, again, that's also how movements have built, whether it's been about, you know, the current, you know, reality of marriage equality in this country, or whether it was about civil rights in the 50s or 60s, or suffragists, you know, in the late 1900s, early 20th century. It's always been about, well, if we stand up and move ahead, maybe someone else will. We'll link arms, and, you know, that's how real change will come about. That's the same, again, recipe that we're up against here. But, again, it comes back to understanding that we have to change the system. We have to revolutionize it. We have to dismantle it, because we live in a corporate state, and we see what the corporate state is capable of. And if we want a future for not only ourselves, but for the generations to come, well, it's on our shoulders to do the work.
And what I am, you know, I just got the 2-minute warning, and we have conversations on our team all the time about, should we go to a half hour format for the show? And I usually end up with shows like this saying, no, we should actually go to the hour and a half format, because I believe that there are thousands of people that are ready to hear what you have to say now more than ever in diverse groups. And I'm so sorry that we didn't get to cover just what the Democracy School is. I read a lot about it. So I encourage everybody to go to celdf.org, celdf.org. There are a number of Facebook pages. Anybody can email me, Gina@Mrs. Green's World. And between Kelly and I, our show producer, will get the information out to you. And my call to action would be to, if you have a cause, go to this website and learn what you can do. What would your call to action be, Kai? Because you get the last word. yeah, in I guess, 30 seconds, you know?
And yeah, embrace your inner levels of defiance.
Yeah.
I mean, question is,
yes.
It's like what we try to teach our kids, question everything, and then if you see something unjust, question authority. And
yes.
We have to,
yes.
That's the tenet, I think, of this work. And if people do that more, then we have potential to actually move
change.
Towards what we all want.
Change.
Yep.
Thank you so much. It's been an honor to spend this hour with you, and thanks for all the work your organization is doing on our behalf. Make it a great green week, everybody, and again, Happy New Year.
Thank you.